You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of December 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
We have shown not just around the state of Alabama, but we have shown the country the way that we can be unified.
More, what is he good for? The voters of Alabama decline the candidacy of Judge Roy Moore and the horse he rode in on. My guests James Chambers and James Rogers will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey suggests that recognizing Jerusalem as someone's capital is a game that others can play, Google furthers its relationship with a country which bans Google, and why is Fox selling out to Disney, and what will Fox do with the money? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are James Chambers, Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief, and James Rogers, Head of International Journalism Studies at City University London. Welcome both. And we will start in Alabama, the voters of which have contributed greatly to the general gaiety by declining to elect to the US Senate the Republican candidate Roy Moore, an unsavory dingbat who seemed a preposterous choice for high office even before his creepy interest in young girls came to light. By an admittedly depressingly narrow margin, Alabama dispatched to Washington instead Doug Jones, the state's first Democrat senator for 25 years, both whittling President Donald Trump's majority in the upper house and enshrining him in history as having endorsed two losing candidates in the same race. James Chambers, first of all, Trump is inevitably now insisting that if the people of Alabama or the Republican primary voters of Alabama had just gone with his first choice, Luther Strange, they would have won. He's probably not wrong there, is he?
Well, it's hard to find a candidate that's perhaps less unelectable than Roy Moore, even though he was still the favorite going into it. So, you know, you're right. If it was anyone else but Roy Moore, then perhaps the Republicans would have won this easily. So, you can't fault Trump's logic there. But, you know, he got behind.
How often do we get to say that?
True. But he can't back away from the fact that he got fully behind Roy Moore. And he held rallies in support of him. So it's a bit rich of Trump to say that now, but it's not the first time he's...
When you say he can't back away, I think give him another 4 or 5 hours and we'll get a tweet saying, who even is Roy Moore? I have literally never heard of him. James Rogers, as James Chambers points out, I'm just going to call you James and James. The listeners will be able to follow it. Roy Moore is, I think, if we're going to put it tactfully, or was rather, an exceptional candidate. I think it's fair to say. That being the case, is there actually anything really to be read into this beyond, which is not to downplay the significance of what has taken place, but is there a wider lesson here?
I think that's quite a difficult conclusion to draw at this stage. I mean, the consequences are, as you pointed out, then it reduces the Republican majority in the Senate. It also, for Mr. Trump, somebody who doesn't like to lose and certainly doesn't like to lose so publicly, is a blow to his ego, which is something about which he cares greatly, obviously. But I think the longer term consequences, it's difficult conclusions to draw because of the very precise nature of this particular election, and because it seems clear, first time in 25 years, as you say, a number of Republicans decided to vote for the Democrat candidate on this occasion, and they couldn't necessarily relied upon to do so again in the future.
I rather suspect quite a lot of Republicans stayed home. James, on the subject of who did vote, there's some fairly depressing revelations yielded by the breakdowns, especially among race. 95% of the black vote was against Roy Moore and for Doug Jones for fairly obvious enough reasons. But only 27% of the white vote was for Doug Jones. Roy Moore still polled quite well among white people in Alabama.
I guess you need to look into those numbers a bit deeper as well. So Doug Jones got a lot of support from young people, from young people living in cities, educated people as well. So even though there is a big split on race, age plays a part in it too. A lot of kind of older conservative whites would have gone for more, would have been more susceptible to his pitch. So It is depressing. It is depressing that he was even had a chance of winning. But I think we can take a positive light from the fact that, you know, the young people, educated people, people living in cities were supporting Doug Jones.
What does it tell us, though, James, that Roy Moore was even, you know, not merely a plausible candidate, as we've been discussing, was actually, you know, you could still get 3 or 4 to 1 against Doug Jones this time yesterday. You know, an obviously, you would think, ludicrous candidate, entirely unelectable, you would think. And just thinking only for myself, if there was a candidate running for office, even if it was one with whose politics I broadly agreed, if the revelations of about their personal life and personal history were akin to what we have learned about Roy Moore, I would cast my vote elsewhere on character grounds alone.
Well, that's right. And I think one of the points that the Democrats have been trying to put forward after this result is that this shows that there is an alternative to the divisive politics of the United States that we've seen over the last couple of years. But I'm not sure that's actually true because of the amount of people who did turn out to vote for Mr. Moore.
It's become almost an act
closest to the vote.
But it's become an act of faith, hasn't it, rather than a political choice people make. They will vote. Well, I mean, we are seeing here the confirmation they would vote for literally anything with a Republican rosette attached to it.
Well, that's right. I mean, if we see that, and as I say, if we see the margin here and the fact that Mr. Moore could refuse to concede and with 99% of the vote counted, it shows how very close it was that he felt that that was a tenable position. He did lose, of course, in the end. But it does show that the United States remains deeply divided. And if the Democrats are drawing some small comfort from it, it may just be that this result came because of the very exceptional circumstances of this particular race.
James, are there in fact wider lessons here for the Democrats? Is there something to be said for the fact that all other factors notwithstanding, what we learned about Roy Moore notwithstanding, Doug Jones is an extremely serious candidate, a solid, proper person with a enviable and, you know, commendable track record. Is that the way forward? Just put up decent, qualified people and hope everything else works out?
Well, as James said, it was extremely close.
It was very, very tight.
And we're looking at someone who shouldn't have been on the ticket against someone with, you know, he's got the working class background from the steel mill industry. He has this amazing case on his CV where he prosecuted some Ku Klux Klan people who were responsible for killing some people down there. So, in a sense, the Democrats, you know, found a great guy to win this race, but it went down to the wire and it's still not over yet. You know, Roy Moore's refusing to concede, so who knows what could happen. And there are some people saying this, you know, this does show that this it's gone down to a character vote, and people have voted for Doug Jones based on his character and against Roy Moore. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I don't think it's convincing enough.
I think that there's worse bases to make judgments on between political candidates. Just a final thought on this one, James. Does it, and I'm inserting my own wishful thinking into the question, does this fatally wound the reputation of Steve Bannon as this arch, cunning, wise manipulator?
I think it's probably a minor setback. I mean, even the arch, cunning, wisest manipulator in the world experiences some setbacks, and perhaps that's just what this is. Whether his broader political career is going to take a significant, or reputation is going to take a significant hit from this, is another matter, I think.
Well, let's move along slightly, because nearly a year into his presidency, Donald Trump's appreciation of the relationship between actions and consequences remains suboptimal. His recent decision to disregard absolutely all informed opinion and formally recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel was always going to prompt some violence, and indeed it did. It has now also resulted in a commendably witty response from the Arab and wider Muslim world. 57 countries, convened by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, are now calling upon the world to recognize Palestine and East Jerusalem as the capital thereof. James, I'm starting to perceive a certain pattern to Trump's decision making. I think we're witnessing the birth or the acceleration of something which we might think of as the Trump effect, i.e. the precise opposite of everything he wants to accomplish is actually what happens.
Well, I think he could have been really clever and kind of by announcing that he was going to have the recognize Jerusalem as the Israeli capital and also East Jerusalem as the Palestinian
one. There was some speculation that he was, the form of words he would use would be to recognize West Jerusalem as Israel's capital, but that of course didn't happen.
It didn't happen, yes. And I think, you know, he missed a trick. I wonder whether he's kicking himself or, you know, I'm giving him too much credit. You know, Erdogan is, it's not a ridiculous proposition that people should get behind this idea that we can recognize East Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. I know that Erdogan has a lot of respect in the Muslim world, and people look up to him as a very strong leader of a majority Muslim country. So even though his reputation has been tarnished a lot in the West since he took a bit more of an authoritarian turn, he still does command a very strong position in the Muslim world. So, you know, what he says does carry weight.
But James, it's hard, I think, to formulate, should you be interested in so doing, any kind of dismissal of this or retort to this, because there was a convenient hypocrisy always around Jerusalem. The idea was that this was a can that was just being kicked repeatedly down the road, and this would all be sorted out as part of a final settlement, which was something everybody had more or less agreed to. Now, if it's been decided by the United States to preempt that and recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, is there any good reason why East Jerusalem should not be recognized as Palestine's capital?
None whatsoever, and there may be recognitions of that nature which follow. But in practice, of course, you know, Israel controls both half of the city. In practice as well. And this is something that Mr. Trump's supporters have tried to a point they've tried to make is the offices of the Israeli government are in Jerusalem. Yet, of course, you know, the embassies all remain in Tel Aviv because Jerusalem has been the subject of every single peace plan put forward probably since 1948 and indeed before is thought of as an international city, but that is not the way things are in practice. I think Mr. Trump knew exactly what he was doing. This is a very strong message of support to Israel. It is a snub to the Palestinians and indeed to the wider Arab and Muslim world, and this is what the kind of response that we've seen from the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And I think if I covered this conflict for a couple of years as a correspondent, if the Palestinians did not always trust the United States because of its strong support for Israel, they did at least believe the United States had the ability to influence Israel, and that could therefore one day be a determining factor in bringing a peace agreement. I think to a large extent that trust has disappeared.
I'm trying to be optimistic here, James. Is it possible that this precipitate move by the United States might inadvertently force some sort of resolution? Because what happens if these 57 countries, many very serious, powerful countries among them, do announce that they will recognize East Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine and insist that they will now start dispatching ambassadors and building embassies?
As James said, Israel controls that part of Jerusalem, so I'm not sure they'd be able to how far they'd get with building these embassies in Jerusalem, because
but announcing their intention to do so would put Israel in a fairly tricky position.
Well, yes and no. They Israel is obviously notoriously very very stubborn. They're not going to bend to international will on this, like they don't on a lot of things. So I don't see how they would concede to letting these other embassies, you know, spring up in East Jerusalem. I think, you know, it's right that the US and Trump have lost a lot of their leverage by giving in on this point, and their abilities to influence Israel is obviously lesser now that Israel's got what they wanted. I think it's a lot of responsibility falls on what countries like the UK and France and Germany now do. They've condemned the move, but what's next? You know, what's next for the EU to say? Not just let this one drop, but perhaps work with countries like Turkey on a roadmap forward for how we can make a kind of collective response to this.
On the subject of embassies, James, how, as things presently stand, do we like the chances of this US embassy in Jerusalem ever actually being built?
I think it's going to depend on how long Mr. Trump remains president for. If he wins a second term, it's the sort of thing he might actually try to put into practice during that second term. None of the reports which have come out in response to this announcement last week have suggested that this is something for the very short term. It seems more an expression of intent, because we know there have been several votes in the US Congress proposing just such a move, which have always been stayed
this
by the president.
This goes back 20 years.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, this is highly symbolic, but I'm not sure we can expect this to happen soon, and indeed there's no sort of suggestion that it would. But I think, as I say, I think the consequences of this are likely to be further down the road, because whatever solution were one to be found to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict could be put forward, the United States has really, since the end of the Cold War, been seen as the main sponsor of that. And I think, to a large extent, in the eyes of the Muslim world, and particularly the Palestinians, it has lost that authority.
I wonder where the posting to the new Jerusalem embassy would rank on the hardship posting for the US State Department. Because the embassy in Tel Aviv now, even though it is fortified, it's actually quite accessible compared to what you'd think in that part of the world. But if they moved it to Jerusalem, it'd have to be a proper fortress.
I do keep thinking of my visit to the US Embassy in Beirut in 2001, which was, I mean, obviously they'd had the two previous buildings blown up and were therefore a little bit rigorous is the word I would use to characterize the security. And in a city as crowded as West Jerusalem, it's just from a logistical point of view, it's very difficult to imagine how doable this is. James, just a brief final thought on this. How do you assess Jared Kushner's progress in bringing the Middle East together?
Well, I mean, the
telltale guffaws around the table.
Yeah, not great so far. I mean, I think it's going to be interesting to see what role he is actually going to play. He has been put forward as some sort of a player, but I think it's quite hard to see. I mean, just on the point of diplomats and whether they'd want to go there, it's interesting. I mean, having talked to a couple of former US ambassadors to Israel, there is something about this huge challenge, this huge diplomatic challenge of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which does attract people there. It's like one of those mathematical theorems which remains unsolved for centuries. You know, people really want to have a go. So I think, you know, difficult though it may be, it will continue to attract diplomats who want to try to solve it.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with James Chambers and James Rogers. Coming up next, we welcome our new artificially intelligent Chinese robot overlords.
This Christmas, alongside established Monocle favourites to place under the tree, why not treat your friends and loved ones to some of our new collaborations? A truly fragrant festive treat comes courtesy of Monocle Alpine by Trez. Our friends from Sud Tirol have developed a line of products from shampoo to face cream that will transport you to the serene surroundings of northern Italy. Combining sleek, lightweight design with robust Spanish workmanship, the items in the Monocle Leather Collection are produced and manufactured in collaboration with Comme des Garçons. We've also teamed up with the US brand Topo to rework a selection of their classic pieces. Topo have fused traditional style with modern functionality to develop rucksacks and pouches made using Cordura nylon fabric and a coated pack cloth lining. And they're available exclusively to Monocle. So happy shopping and a very happy Christmas from everyone at Monocle.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are James Chambers and James Rogers. Now, in news that may come as a surprise to any listeners in China who've ever attempted to Google something, because they can't, Google has announced plans to open an artificial intelligence research center in China. It will be the first facility of its kind in Asia, joining similar setups in London, Zurich, Toronto, and New York. James Chambers, first of all, is it odd that Google is doing business with China?
It might seem odd at first,
it
obviously, because their search engine doesn't work. But, you know, they have a massive office in China already, employing some like 600 people. And China is obviously a massive talent pool in this industry. So it's not stupid of Google to want to tap that industry. And at the end of the day, you know, China has about 750 million internet users, and Google does more than just a search engine. But looking at the long term, Google would like their search engine to be available in China, and you know, this can be seen as part of their kind of cozying up to the government in Beijing and showing that they're investing in China and they want to maybe kickstart that conversation again. You know, they left effectively in 2010 because they weren't willing to self-censor. You know, we must all applaud that, but I think they perhaps have realized the financial ramifications of that. And as they're competing with not only Amazon, but the massive Chinese technology companies like Tencent, they can't afford to be out of China.
James, is that your sense that Google having realized that taking bat and ball and flouncing off didn't really butter any parsnips? That is a shocking mixed metaphor. but anyway, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Is trying to sort of ingratiate themselves into the Chinese ambitions on the AI field going to help them in the long run, do you think?
That's a very good question, but I think that's exactly, you know, what their intention is. You know, as James has pointed out, millions and millions of internet users, a massive number of consumers, a massive economy. Seems strange for a global company not to want to try to get themselves in there to some extent, and possibly, you know, that in the longer term to you know, have a broader presence in there rather than just what looks like research cooperation. But, you know, if Google are saying that they're convinced that AI is the future, a lot of talent, as James says, in China, so it seems like there are, you know, even if there are tensions there, like Google not being able to, it's their search engine not being able to operate there are grounds for significant cooperation, which may be mutually beneficial in a greater extent in the future.
Well, on that front, James, what does this apparent vote of confidence by Google tell us about the level of expertise available in China in the AI field?
Well, you know, the Chinese government have made artificial intelligence a major focus for the economy, and they want to, you know, generate $60 billion a year by 2025. So, you know, when the Chinese government behind it, when the president's behind it, you know, Google is going to get a lot of plaudits if it supports that and is seen to support that. There is, you know, there's so many talented workers in China. Google is not the biggest name in China. That's the thing. They're going to have to compete with the Tencents and the Huawei's to try and attract these people. And I think Google is getting a lot of PR play from something that actually isn't necessarily a big story, because it's effectively just adding a few people in its Beijing office and saying they're going to do a bit of AI research. So they're not really putting their money where their mouth is quite yet. This is probably just just the early days. Let's see how far this goes and how much money they do actually invest in this. In terms of talent, you know, it's essentially hedging their bets. There's a lot of talent in the US, but China's quickly catching up, and the government wants to make AI one of their big things, and it thinks it's an area where China can compete with the US.
James, is there a potential PR issue here for Google as AI becomes more and more of a thing? Might this be a bit seen as a bit akin to, I don't know, NASA opening a branch office in Moscow in about 1962?
Yeah, possibly. And I think the big question is, what's this AI going to be used for? You know, is it going to be used to make the world the most wonderful place, or is it like social media was 10 years ago, or are we going to find out in 10 years?
That's gone well, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, indeed. And maybe, you know, it depends, because obviously a lot of AI could be used for surveillance, and indeed, you know, already is. So I think there are questions over, you know, what the purpose, what directions this research is going to take, and it could not necessarily go well. But, you know, as we've been saying, I think Google clearly think that to rule it out altogether at this stage would be potentially to miss a colossal opportunity.
And James, is there a illustration here of how China is trying to still find its way in the world? I mean, it does seem a perfect expression of this balance between engagement and isolation. On the one hand, you know, the world's most popular search engine you cannot use inside China, and yet they're still attempting to engage with the company that builds it, and then to engage with foreign companies and set up, you know, cooperation across borders. Is that going to be sustainable forever?
Well, we all think of the internet as one thing, and China has very much come out and said, well, there's the American internet and there's the Chinese internet we want to build. You know, they have this massive internet conference every year, which has just happened, and it's basically the Chinese saying, we want to set our own rules for the internet that applies in China. You know, and that type of internet is also very appealing to other authoritarian countries who want to control what people can and can't see. So I guess what the Chinese are saying is that, you know, we don't accept the American internet. We want to set our own rules. And if you want to play by our rules, you know, you've got to come to China and consent to what we say you have to do. So this is the fact that Google, you know, what we think is probably the biggest internet company in the world, feels like it has to go to China, shows, I guess, the state of play at the moment.
Okay, well, finally tonight, something which has not happened yet but seems likely to, is the purchase of a hefty chunk of 21st Century Fox by Disney. It will mean that Disney will take charge of such TV channels as FX, Sky Sports and National Geographic and the streaming service Hulu. It will also obviously necessitate a reorienting of Fox, which will keep Fox News, Fox Sports and its US broadcast network, or so we think so far. James Rogers, what is in this for Disney? Should they be a bit anxious about the fact that Fox, which is run by people who've made profitable decisions more often than they have not, is willing to sell?
Yes, I think this is a very, very interesting moment in modern media history. I mean, you know, Mr. Murdoch has spent decades building up the empire which he's acquired. He's been hugely successful on both sides of the Atlantic and in many other parts of the world. And I wonder if we're at a moment where he's deciding that, you know, some of his more traditional media holdings are not really where the future of his company, and he's not sure how this is going to go. Because, of course, one of the things which is being speculated is that his son James may then get a senior position with Disney as part of the deal. So it's a very interesting moment, I think. You know, Mr. Murdoch has remained loyal to newsprint, and then, even though he saw the potential of satellite television in Europe long before others, and delivered on that. So I think it's a very interesting moment that he is, it seems, preparing to break up some of his empire.
I don't think there's not been an explanation why he would be wanting to sell these assets.
No, there are a lot of blind speculation to which we are now contributing.
There's an interesting, fascinating play on in the West End called Inc., and it's about Rupert Murdoch building up, acquiring the Sun, and then building it up to eventually overtake the circulation of the Daily Mirror. And when it finally does that, at the end of the play, it's like, well, what's next? And Murdoch says, well, I'm quite interested by the U.S., and obviously, that's where this part of the story then takes over. He goes and builds up his Fox empire. You know, is this Murdoch calling time on the US now and saying, actually, I'm more interested in somewhere else? Is he going to be taking his money and, you know, developing an empire somewhere else? Or
it would be surprising on form if Murdoch was resigning himself to a quiet retirement at this stage. What might Fox do with the money? Because there will be a lot of it, it seems reasonable to assume.
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think if you look at the sort of way things have gone over the last 10 or 20 years, I mean, Mr. Murdoch has been a successful press baron in the sense that he has understood the nature of change as it came and positioned himself to take advantage of it, with one, I would say, big exception. I think the press barons of the 20th century and into the late 20th century have simply been overtaken and outstripped by the tech giants, who now really have the real power in many, many spheres of media, but not least, of course, in news gathering and distribution, which has always been the heart of Mr. Murdoch's business. So I wonder if he is going to try to get into that game later, or maybe he is. You know, maybe this is a move towards retirement, although, as you say, past experience would tend to suggest against that.
I mean, James, what James says is true, that Murdoch is arguably the last of the old school newspaper barons. If he is deciding to check out of that business to a certain extent, for all the criticisms that have been made about him, quite many of them reasonable ones, might we miss him once he's gone?
Well, I guess if we look at what he's selling, he's essentially selling the cinema and TV assets. He's keeping his, you know, he spent a lot of money buying the Wall Street Journal.
This is true.
He's not selling that.
Also true.
So he's selling out of Hollywood. And I guess he's buying into this whole trend of the cord-cutting millennials who are no longer watching TV anymore. So, you know, perhaps he will resurface in China, buying into cinema assets there, where it seems to be doing a lot better. Who knows? I think he's a newspaper man through and through. There's no indication that he's going to sell those assets at the moment. So, you know, he might be still showing how savvy he is as a media operator and just moving his money elsewhere. He is newly married.
That just seems like a funny idea, but it's true.
Maybe he does want to have a bit more fun. But I think there's also an interesting family dynamic here, because James Murdoch, his son, you know, was the chosen one. Then there was rumours of a bit of a falling out, especially with all the scandals in the UK with the phone tapping. Now he might end up with a job at Disney. So You know, it'd be interesting to know what's going on there and how the family issues are ironing themselves out.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. James Chambers and James Rogers, thank you both for joining us at Midori House. It was produced by Henry Rhys Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tasha Kleeman. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs with Matt Alagaya. More on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.